Vera Menchik. If anybody can identify, without the use of Google, who Vera Menchik was, what do they get, Tom? I don't know. I was going to say you get a free membership, but then I realized you probably don't. Vera Menchik, and since I'm now going to tell you, if you come up afterwards and say you knew, you don't get your free membership anyway, was for most of the 20th century the only female grandmaster of chess, thereby demonstrating clearly that women couldn't be as good as men at chess except for one random exception. In fact, Bobby Fischer, in his very brief span as champion of the world, before he became even more crazy than he was in his early days, said that he could give any woman knight odds and still win. In other words, a piece, which at a high level of chess is an unbelievable advantage, like beginning a professional basketball game with 20 or 30 points to the other team. And at the time that he said it, he was probably right. But then a man in Hungary named Polgár decided that he was going to raise his three young girls to be chess players the way that boys were raised to be chess players. All three of them became masters, and one of them, Judith, became one of the top five players in the world. Not only could Bobby Fischer not give her knight odds, but given that he's rusty and crazy, he probably couldn't even beat her in a match. And this reminds us that what we take as innate is sometimes more a product of how people are conditioned than what they're born with. They did a study recently in a Brooklyn high school about girls and boys who play chess, and what they found was that girls progressed as quickly as boys until girls started to drop out and girls didn't have other girls to play with, and so they started to lag behind. That you need that peer reinforcement, people around you who will do the same thing that you will do so you'll feel good about it. Now, I'm not going to argue that there aren't differences between men and women. There are profound differences. There are differences in the way their brains are constructed and the way their brains work. I don't know, and I'm not sure anybody does, exactly what that means, Larry Summers notwithstanding. And I'm not going to get in trouble the way he did by making any rash pronouncements one way or the other. But what is clear is that if we want to understand the way that women can function in history, we have to look at it differently than the way we have to so far. Just as Mr. Polgár decided that he was going to try something that hadn't been tried, which is, instead of assuming that women couldn't play chess, raise them as if they could. So what I'd like to do today is look at the Bible as a story of women. I want to do this because of Shavuot. And you know, Shavuot is, after all, the holiday of Ruth, where we read the book of Ruth. And yesterday was also a holiday. What was yesterday? Rosh Chodesh. And Rosh Chodesh is the holiday of women in the Jewish tradition. And if you don't know why, then listen up. It starts with Eve. Now, there are lots of ways of interpreting what Eve did, not all of them flattering. But it's clear that what God says to Adam, because you listened to what Eve said and ate the fruit that I told you was forbidden, you will be cursed in the following ways, should not be interpreted as, because you did what Eve said, I will curse you, but because you did what Eve said, which was wrong, I will curse you. I'll prove that in just a minute. But what strikes me about the whole story, of course, is who is the agent of change here? It's Eve. Without Eve, Adam would still be sitting under the tree, presumably in paradise, but without the possibility of striving, achieving, growing, or moving towards redemption. Adam probably didn't notice his surroundings, whereas Eve presumably didn't like to live in a place that she didn't have a hand in decorating. She wanted the place to be what she wanted because she was the active agent of change, whereas Adam was kind of passive. She gives him a fruit, he eats it. He doesn't get active until it's time to blame Eve. Then he speaks up. But once they move out into the world, and all sorts of catastrophes befall human beings, Noah, the Tower of Babel, and so on, we come to Abraham and Sarah. And even though it seems as though the focus of the story is Abraham, when the pivot comes, when Isaac is to be born for redemption, whose choice is it that Isaac will carry on the tradition? It's Sarah's and not Abraham's. It's Sarah who says Ishmael has to leave the house because Isaac's going to be the one. And when Abraham doesn't want to do it, what does God say to him? Everything that Sarah tells you, you must do. Thereby disproving the idea that God criticized Adam just because Eve was a woman. Rather, God criticized Adam because Eve said the wrong thing. Because he goes and turns around and says to Abraham, everything Sarah tells you, you better do. Which makes God not only clearly impartial in terms of who offers the wisdom to the world, but I would say the first effective marriage counselor offering some advice that I think would make much happier homes. This, by the way, is not only my word. You know that they did a study of couples and found that within the home, couples almost universally who are happier followed one rule. Inside the home, the wife called the shots. I wouldn't dare invent this. I am just reporting. And this same principle of the woman being not, I'm not talking now about dictating the home, but being the agent of change when change needs to be made, happens in the next story that leads to redemption, which is that of Judah and Tamar. Judah refuses to allow Tamar to marry another of his sons, so what does she do? She tricks Judah into having a child with her. And if you follow the genealogy, what does that child lead to? To King David and the Messiah. Which means that, again, as with Sarah, as with Eve, the chain of redemption is linked together by the initiative of a woman. The same thing happens when you go to the Israelites go to Egypt. First of all, when they leave Egypt and they have to summon Joseph's coffin and they don't know where it is and Moses doesn't know, do you remember who it is in our tradition that knows the tradition before they came to Egypt? There is only one name that is mentioned in the list before we get to Egypt and mentioned in the list after we leave Egypt. Sarah bat Asher. We know nothing about her except that she lived apparently through the entire hundreds of years of slavery and, say the rabbis, that she was the one who remembered where Joseph's coffin was. Because the tradition is carried on, and here it is a perfect example of the way the tradition is carried on, not through writing but the oral tradition, mother to daughter through the generations. And Sarah bat Asher, she remembers. She doesn't have the book that says where Joseph is, but she has the oral tradition. And Moses comes to her to find out where Joseph is. When they leave, and it is time to express joy to God, who is it that leads the singing and the dancing? Miriam. Miriam, who is also responsible as the Israelites walk through the desert, for what? For water. Remember that right after Miriam dies, all the wells close up. There is no water left. The Mayim Chayim, living waters, in our tradition, is a euphemism for Torah. So that tradition, both written and oral, is carried in a substantial way by women through the desert until we get to the land of Israel. But even more important, the great sin that almost scuppers the whole endeavor, almost ruins it, is the sin of the golden calf. And there is one prominent group of Israelites that do not participate in the worship of the golden calf. I'll give you one guess. The women. How do we know this? I hear you cry. Euphemistically. I'll tell you how we know this. Because it says, Ha'am, the people, come to Moses. I'd rather come to Aaron and ask him for Nizmei Zahav to build a golden, Ha'am comes to him and asks him to build a golden calf. And he turns to Ha'am, the people, and says, I need these rings. These Nizmei Zahav, these golden ornaments, in order to build the golden calf. So go home and ask your wives. From which the rabbis deduce that Ha'am does not refer to the women. And then, interestingly enough, Ha'am comes back with the gold. But there's a way in which we know that the gold they got was not gold from women. Because later on, in the next chapter, when the Israelites build the tabernacle, not the golden calf, it says that they got the Nizmei Zahav from the Anashim Unashim, from the men and the women, not from Ha'am. And the difference in language, which the rabbis assume is deliberate, shows us that in one case, what we identify as the nation was in fact only the men. And it wasn't until we were building a tabernacle and not an idol that women got involved. That's why, by the way, since I promised I would answer the question, the holiday of Rosh Chodesh, which was intended originally for the Levi'im, was given as a holiday for women. It was going to represent the 12 tribes, 12 chodashim, 12 months, 12 tribes, but because of the merit of the women, ha'anashim ba'al ha'anashim, men and women together who built the tabernacle, they get the holiday. Obviously, there are other ties with Rosh Chodesh and women, the way it ties into the cycle of a woman's body, but there's also a historical tie. And all of this brings us to Naomi and Ruth. The story is the story of Ruth, but as you know, if you read the book, the one who is arranging things behind the scenes is Naomi. And in this, by the way, she again has a biblical precursor whom I've not yet mentioned. If you think, who is a woman who behind the scenes arranges things so that everything comes out the way it's supposed to, so that the right son gets the blessing? It's Rebecca. Remember, when Jacob steals the blessing from his father, is it his idea? No, he's a kid. His mother comes to him and says, here, put this on. Go say that. Everything will be fine. In fact, Maurice Samuel, the writer and philosopher, wrote an essay about Rebecca, and he titled it, Rebecca the Manager. And he goes through the whole story and shows how at every step, Rebecca subtly arranges things so that Isaac and Jacob do what she wants. But it also happens to be what is necessary, in the same way that Sarah does what is necessary. And in the same way that Rachel and Leah, between them, arranged to get 12 tribes. And now we come to Ruth and Naomi. And remember the story. Naomi has two sons. They're married to two women Orpah and Ruth. Both of her sons die. She says, look, I'm going back to Israel, where I came from. There's nothing for you there. You go find yourselves husbands, because I have no more sons. Orpah says, okay, I'll go. And Ruth says, where you go, I will go. That famous declaration that people who convert to Judaism learn, remember that it is made from one woman to another. It's not made from a Jew to God. It's not made from a man to a man. It's not made from a convert to a rabbi. It's made from one woman to another. Your people, she says, shall be my people, and your God, my God. Having said that, what does Naomi then do? She manipulates and arranges and manages the story so that Ruth again and again puts herself in front of Boaz. Poor Boaz, who is relatively clueless to what's going on. And all of a sudden, by the end of the story, finds himself married to Ruth. But of course, what comes out of the marriage of Boaz and Ruth? The Messiah. When I said that women are responsible for redemption, I meant it very literally. It's just that we don't always look at the story that way. It's the story of Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Leah and Miriam and Ruth. Again and again, at critical moments in Jewish history, it is in fact women who bring redemption. And I wonder sometimes if this deep story, which we learn and we know, if you've read the Bible, I haven't just told you anything you didn't already know. Even though you may not have isolated and teased out that thread before now, but I wonder if that deep story is what allowed Israel, which is, after all, at the time, not a nation that had gone through any kind of American equivalent of a women's liberation movement. I wonder if that was what allowed Israel, what, 30 years ago, to elect a woman as prime minister. Not what you would have expected. But there was this sense built in to the DNA of our tradition that women can bring redemption. And here's my last piece of evidence. God's presence on earth is the Shekhinah. And the Shekhinah is feminine. The way in which God moves in this world, to the extent that you can supply gender to something that is beyond gender, is feminine. Which is strange because, as you know, in the Bible, again and again and again, how is God referred to? As masculine. But when it comes to speaking about how God moves in this world, moves through this world, will bring redemption to the world, all of a sudden, as it were, God is a woman. So, between Rosh Chodesh and Shavuot, we should remember and celebrate the fact that our genders are separate, that each intermixes and yet brings something special, and realize that there is this beautiful silver thread that runs through our tradition from the beginning with Eve through Sarah and Rebecca and Sarah bat Asher and Miriam and Ruth and Naomi and so many others, and even in the end includes in its weave the Shekhinah, the presence of God. And I hope, whether you are a man or a woman, that you will celebrate the presence and the love of women in your life, because after all, as we have learned, in ways small and eternal, they bring redemption. Shabbat shalom.